To be carried out by the Cynicists at the upcoming World Soccer Tournament. Now, some of you, I'm hoping you guys have read two things or been told about two things. There was one that came out pretty much May 24th. This one. LaRouche warns Cheney plans to launch an Iran strike in June. The second one came out on the 29th, I believe. 27th. Going through the whole Cynicist operation right now to create pretty much a class of civilizations in the Southwest Asia. And pretty much want to set up a terrorist incident which Dick Cheney could use to launch preemptive strikes on Iran. So that's pretty much been happening. So you've got pretty much a world on fire right now in terms of you've got a lot of incidents, you've got an economy that's pretty much in spasmodic. Earthquakes are hitting, it's going up and down like an epileptic fit. And this has pretty much prompted Lynn to write a paper called, and this is the one I want to focus on tonight because it's really going at the heart of the embedded cultural problems we have today. What's actually causing the problems in the economy? What's causing these problems within actual functioning society? And it will right now, which is pretty dysfunctional as a result of pretty much like this whole war on terror right now. You have things like explosion in commodities. Now, what's the actual underlying cause for this? Because we know the commodities are going through the roof right now. I mean, that's pretty clear that as a result, you look at like things like copper or gold or oil, these things are going through the roof. Now, that's sort of the things that we can take in just from empirical observation. But there's also underneath that, what Lynn is looking at is this moral crisis. So he wrote this paper called The Cities of the Plain, which is a biblical reference to two towns which were, I don't know, around, just like the places in the Bible, I don't know where they are, probably around where today would be Israel, Iraq, that region, Syria. And there's two towns that get referenced called Sodom and Gomorrah. Now these two towns, Sodom, well, it has some follow-on terms today, Sodomy and etc., etc. These towns where pretty much it was very, very morally corrupt, degenerate, bestial society, completely full of sin. And what actually happened is these towns were pretty much destroyed under God's command, pretty much. Like there was too much sin there. They didn't have the moral fitness to So this is pretty much the title of this paper. I think it's here somewhere. And you all should read this or get a copy of it afterwards. Where he's going through, all right, what actually fundamentally needs to change in our way of viewing human beings in order to have a functioning society? What actually has to happen? What do we have to convey and go out there and educate people on? And what we need to create the conditions for them to discover so we actually have a functioning long civilization, not something like what you saw with Rome or Babylon back in the day when you had like the collapse of whole cultures. So I want to situate this now we just had a briefing by Phil Rubenstein on the West Coast, giving a bit of an update on some of the developments. And there's two I want to point to, because we're right now in a very chaotic sort of situation with, you've had, over the last few weeks in Britain, you've had Tony Blair's come under increasing attacks. It's pretty dysfunctional over there. You've had riots in France with Chirac. You have a non-government in Italy, which pretty much can't really govern. at this point. It hasn't got much of a solid hold on anything. And also in Germany you've had demonstrations, and then in the United States itself, the Bush-Cheney administration right now is dysfunctional. Now Bush cannot put anything through. Pretty much, he's pretty much confined to the rubber room he occupies, because he needs exercise to control his rage. And Dick Cheney right now is more unpopular than Bush. Now there was a report, some polls that were conducted the last few days, where people of the United States are saying that Bush is more unpopular than Richard Nixon, Dick Nixon. So with Dick Cheney more unpopular than Bush, that means Bush is stuck between two dicks. So not a good place to be.
So this is where the reference to Solomon comes in.
Yeah. Well, it's probably very appropriate for what's going on right now. So you've got that sort of situation. So you've got, because the presidency's made up more of just Dick Cheney and George Bush. You have in there an institution of the presidency, which is made up of joint chiefs of staff. You have former representatives of former administrations. They're called the institutional layer. And they're right now moving to pretty much to sort of create some stability in there. And so they put forth, as a result of the pressure from these former layers through not so much the neocon crowd but others, they put through this guy, replaced Jon Snow, who was the Treasury Secretary, with a guy called Henry Hank Paulson. Who's a good friend of Robert Rubin, who was Clinton's Treasury Secretary. And this guy's been brought in because they recognise that he'll be able to keep a cool head in a financial crisis, something that will blow up. And then you also have Condi Rice, one of George Shultz's assets at this point, pretty much plucked and pruned to be one of Shultz's greatest assets. I'll get into George Shultz a bit later on. But she, at this point, just announced she is prepared to begin or to conduct bilateral talks with Iran if Iran gives up, suspends its enrichment process of uranium. So that's completely, this is pretty much the first time since about, I think, 1979 that the United States is prepared to look at this. So you sort of have, in amongst all this stuff, this movement that's taking place, you have a move by institutional layers to sort of find some sort of a stability. But the key to keep in mind here is with Dick Cheney in there, and with the syndicates that these banking circles like George Shultz and Felix Rowerton, who I'll start talking about in a minute, with these guys still in there, there's still a great danger of there being some sort of a terrorist incident this coming World Cup. And even if it's averted there, somewhere else. Because the greatest asset, as I was saying before, is that of the banking circles right now that have been hit by this economic crisis, is Dick Cheney in the presidency. And they're going to want him, they want this war in order to consolidate power. So what LaRouche did with this is he's pretty much acting as a whistleblower. And he's blowing the whistle on a group which he called the Syndicus Fifth Column. A fifth column operation run by financial bankers and things like that. To give you a bit of history of this, I'm probably racing a bit, I can slow down. But what I mean by a fifth column is that in pretty much before World War II, you had, I don't know the exact year, you had a Spanish Civil War. And in this war, this is pretty much where the term fifth column comes from, is you had four columns or four armies of troops from Francisco Franco, who eventually took over, who was advancing on Madrid. And what happens is that pretty much these troops are saying, do we have enough power to take Madrid? Because Franco, he's a dictator, it's a civil war. They wanted Madrid, and all these troops were saying, well, do we have enough power? Can we do it? And they were really worried that they'd have a strong resistance. So Franco said, no, don't worry. We have a fifth column inside Madrid, which were pretty much the ones that were going around organizing disorganization amongst, pretty much amongst the resistant forces of the actual leadership of that, of the actual opposing forces at that time. And so by doing so, this sort of undercover force pretty much completely discombobulated the enemy by making it completely pessimistic, throwing it into disorganization, whereby Franco could come through and take out Madrid. Idea of an elephant. Oh, okay, maybe that's not the best example. I was going to say an elephant under the carpet, but yeah, a secret force operating undercover. And so this is what we're saying when you have a Cynicus fifth column. And this thing, in this paper, it goes through it in this paper here, The Empire versus the Nations, Cynicism, Sports, the Sport and Run. Where it talks about the what's called the Maginot Line, which is in World War II, you had the German forces who pretty much had a policy called Blitzkrieg. Blitzkrieg is when it was a combination of rapid land gaining of land with tanks and artillery, assisted with air support, pretty much the air force, and these guys moved very, very quickly, and sort of they were taking, like, because the Germans they have a lot of ingenuity when it comes to war tactics.
Blitzkrieg stands for fast fight.
Oh, lightning war, yeah, same thing. Where you have, this idea, they also, and a term that goes back that we always refer to, Auftrag's tactic, is that they had this, like, do whatever is necessary to get things done. Now, I'm not saying that's great. In this context, what actually happened is they advanced on France. And it was through the Cynicist grouping in France at that time which led to the failure of the resistance of the French forces. Now, we've documented that. I refer to you. Look up some of that stuff. Get a hold of it. Talk to one of us after. We'll find something. But this grouping, this Cynicist grouping, is pretty much these people like George Shultz today, Felix Rollerton. If you look back in history, the links are there. Felix Rollerton right now, banker in the United States, pretty much worked with George Shultz to set up the Augusto Pinochet regime. He's right now we're right now leading a fight against in terms of the Democratic Party over there, and internationally, because he's pretty much the biggest enemy of LaRouche. So he's one of these guys that's connected through channels such as what is called Lazard Frères. It's a bank that he represents. It's traceable back to those who financed Hitler in the 40s and things like that. Part of this Cynicist operation. So that's what we're going through. This is the intervention that Lin's made. This is going out throughout the world right now. It's sprung up in a lot of papers, newspapers across the world. And this is pretty much the uniqueness of Lin and LaRouche's interventions into the political process, because there was no one else that was prepared to step forward and blow the whistle on this thing. And LaRouche actually emphasizes that I didn't do this. This is not just my organization. We heard these warnings coming in, and it was us that we were prepared to act on this. And so what we've done is we're full-on mobilization. We've been getting this out there. And as a result of what our youth movement's been doing, organizing the population. We're putting this knowledge into the people's hands, so they're in a position where they can also affect the change, to get this thing out there and really get people to recognize who's behind this. And that's the way you're going to stop forces like Cheney capitalizing on this sort of activity. And pretty much what we're going to do is kill it in water. And we're gonna, that's an ongoing process. This is what we need people to join us and help us to do. Get out there, recruit more people, and really drive this make it clear in their minds who's actually at work here. Who's behind, who are the people behind the stage pulling the strings. And so there's another, it's really important, I think, with that warning now pretty much laid out there, you guys can look into it more. To bring this back to the actual economic, the economic volatility. Do you have right now, pretty much, we live in a bubble economy. Greenspan, blue bubbles, Bernanke can't blow bubbles, so everyone's getting freaked out. But you've got right now a situation. You sort of get me? Okay, good. You've got a situation where you've got the housing mortgage bubble. We've been talking about that for quite a while. This thing is pretty much, it can't grow anymore because the physical reality of how, like, the physical economy and just the everyday person cannot keep up with this growth, this inflation. So that's it, pretty much at the brink of popping. It's already beginning to do so. And so that's occurring. And you also have, at this time, this is links back into the commodities with the bankers that are freaked out. They're bidding on the futures, pretty much want to buy up as much of this material with the idea that, okay, when the system comes down, I'm going to be in a position where I'll control all the steel or the oil or the gold, what have you. And that they think that rising out of the ashes or something like that, they're going to have a position of influence. The same circles right now that are behind people like Rollerton and Schultz. People like, I'll pretty much elaborate on that in a few minutes. But they recognize this is going down. And so they need to create a new bubble. Because you've had a few in the past. You had pretty much, these began back. The mortgage bubble kicked in 87, but there were bubbles being created before that. And actually, something interesting that I discovered just recently is that the ethanol bubble, this like, you guys have been hearing about how they're talking up ethanol as a fuel source. Pretty much as an alternative to gasoline, to become independent of petroleum. Well, this is not new, but somehow they're trying to breathe new life into it. This actually began, this bubble, the ethanol one, began in the 70s, where you had, in Brazil particularly, this thing took off. What they were doing is relying on huge payouts by the governments to set up the ethanol industry as an alternative. Now, I'm going to show you this is pretty insane. And it goes really to the heart of a lot of actual crises we're dealing with today. This whole talking up of ethanol as an alternative energy source goes at the heart of the cultural crisis we're in, goes to the heart of the political, economic, science crises we're in. And because right now we're dealing with a world who cannot produce enough water for people to drink. In terms of, look at like places like Africa and South America. You have places where they rely pretty much entirely on groundwater, which is drying up. So you have like a population over there that cannot get enough water. And This is why we, right now, are pushing for mass infrastructure development. This is why we actually need to look at new energy forms to deliver water to these areas. things like actual desalination, nuclear desalination, with nuclear energy. Now, this is pretty much the case right now. You're dealing with a resource crisis. You're dealing with a food crisis. And these guys in politics right now are pushing for an advancement in ethanol. Develop more ethanol plants. And it's pretty much, it's a bubble. It cannot survive. Because, and another thing I want to refer you guys to is recent article came out in the EIR going through this whole thing. That you have the same people that were behind the housing bubble, behind the pretty much the bubbles going through the 90s, like the IT bubble, the Y2K bubble, the LTCM bubble, all these speculation markets, who are right now the ones that are pushing this. And ironically, people like George Shultz, Felix Rollerton, are there again. And this is because George Shultz, sits on the board of a company called, of a committee called the Committee for the Present Danger. He's been putting out reports that we need to become energy independent. We need green environmental energy. We need ethanol. We need alcohol. So
we need alcohol.
So we got right now. I think George Bush gets quite a bit of ethanol himself, but that's probably its only good use. Well, okay, maybe not true.
You know, a guy walking with a hat.
Because something that we pretty much has been known for quite a long time, and you could ask pretty much people in the energy industry, the fuel industry, that it requires more fossil fuels, more energy to produce the energy for ethanol, to produce enough ethanol, you need more energy than you get out of it. To make that clearer. That, say you wanted a gallon of ethanol. Well, first of all, it would take about 1,700 gallons of water over the whole course of production to get that. If you were to use a liter of ethanol in your car, it would take more than a liter of ethanol to produce that liter of ethanol to go into your car. So it's a negative energy. It actually takes energy out of your economy. And this is something that is scientifically, you can prove with basic chemistry. Because ethanol is just another variety of the petroleum family. So you've got that scientific, you've got right now within society, people that are pretty much neglecting to look at science. The basic science of this, it doesn't work. It cannot support a growing economy. It pretty much just drags society down because of this pretty much negative energy feedback. And so then you have, at the same time, who's pushing this to create this bubble? It's the food cartels, like these groups. I'll introduce two names, Cargill. It's a Cargill. It's a big company. And another one called ADM, Archer Daniels Midland. Two big companies that have been involved in the ethanol production since about 1971 or something. These guys have been pretty much capitalizing on government payouts to produce this. Because for ethanol to be competitive as a fuel, you need government subsidies. It cannot compete on its own because it would cost like something like $7.21 a gallon. Imagine that, filling up a car on $7.21 a gallon.
Of ethanol.
Hmm?
Sorry, go on. I said that's going to happen before too long on petrol anyway.
One of the other things that was interesting about this is the more ethanol you produce, it drives up the price of petroleum as well.
Huh. Well, that bit about synthetic ethanol.
Can I repeat that? The more ethanol that you try to employ as an energy source, you drive up the price of petroleum.
Why is that?
Because they put ethanol inside the gasoline in most fuels. So you stick that in there, it's going to drive up the price of...
That's why you have like the pumps, like a BP's and all that, to say ethanol free.
Yeah. And so what's another one of the economic... Why this? They constantly talk about Brazil being as their great example. They made it work in Brazil, we can make it work anywhere, or something like that. Well, to give you a sense of the Brazil, because ethanol is derived from corn and sugar. You grow the corn, and then you, the same way you make alcohol, you throw it in a vat, you make it like decompose, and what happens is it ferments, and you produce the chemical alcohol. It's all chemically proven. And that's how they obtain the ethanol. It goes through a refining stage. So you need a lot of land area for the corn to grow. Then you need, as well as sugar, or either one. Corn seems to be more efficient. But what actually happens is, through that process, you're covering more area. And what actually also happens in Brazil is you operate on a slave labor, pretty much these guys operate with slave labor workforce. But these guys are paid. I've got the figures here. I think they pretty much they want their workers to pick about 12 tons of corn a day. Cut 12 tons of corn a day.
It's not per person. So that's
per person.
Per person.
Yeah. In some places, if you don't cut over 8 tons, you get fired. So if you want to get a workout. And make no money, go to Brazil and cut. under the title of Satanic Sugar, you've got where is it here? This is pretty much how it operates. You have, in Brazil, it costs, with this slave labor market, $165 a ton for the corn, whereas in the European Union, in Europe, it costs $700 a ton.
What do you mean it costs food?
Pretty much this is how much they sell, like the equivalent. Sugar production. Well, that's sugar. That's for sugar, which goes towards ethanol, goes towards these sorts.
Gives you
a sense of the actual, like, the pricing on their goods because of the actual cost of labour.
Well, hang on. Who's pricing? I don't get it.
Well, when you sell the product, like Brazil sells it to whoever per ton in the world.
Oh, okay.
They buy it for the equivalent of about $165 US.
Okay.
But you take... take the sugar sold in Europe, it's 700. So the model that these guys are using in promoting ethanol as a fuel source of the future is Brazil, a slave labor system, where the workers there pretty much don't use machinery, and they're cutting this stuff for the purpose of producing a fuel that produces a negative energy, like actually a takes energy out of your economy because it requires more energy to produce than it gives you.
And it's renewable.
And it's renewable, providing that you put have enough rainforest to cut down to make room, because Brazil cut down the actual Amazon rainforest to free up land for this production.
Okay.
So, that's ethanol on an economic basis. Now, our youth movement deployed to New York a few weeks ago because they had a discussion by some leading Democrats. I think it was at a convention, and one of hang on, I've got to do it. A bit disorganized, I'm sorry. Where one of these guys admitted, talked to a leading Democratic representative, one Ohio Democrat congressman addressed a rally promoting the ethanol madness in his home state on May 20, and then stepped off the podium and told a questioner, which was one of us, that he knew ethanol wouldn't work as a solution to high fuel prices. He knew, in fact, that ethanol is expensive and uses up more petrochemical energy in production than it gives back in burning. But he said he was promoting it because he had no better alternative. So, what's the political response to this bubble that has been pushed by these banking forces? Is they say, we know it doesn't work, but we're going to go with it because there's no alternative. When really, the point is that they're too gutless right now. And they don't actually... They're pretty much afraid. And this goes back to... leads into the actual cultural fact. Is they're afraid right now to discuss actual ideas of development. Things like nuclear power. They won't discuss it. Even though right now we have a natural resources crisis across the world, places in Asia and Africa have no water, things like that. They're supporting a policy of pretty much a destruction in the economy. That's sort of the level of sophistry you're seeing right now, level of complete irrationality in political layers. So, to really hone in on this, because this goes back to exactly that issue of the cities of the plain, the actual cultural conditions we're dealing with right now, that you have this baby boomer generation. Now what happened to the baby boomers? They're pretty much those who were born between 1946 and I think 59 roughly, maybe a bit earlier than that, like 40. Pretty much those today who are in the age range of about 50 to 70, these ones came under the attack of the environmentalist movement. These were the ones that were hit with, do not scientifically or technologically progress. Do not support science and development and technology development. It was completely zero technological growth. That was what was being peddled out of places like the Club of Rome, out of a lot of circles, pretty much the head of the environmentalist movement. I looked a bit at a person called Rachel Carson. You had people like Prince Philip. You have a heap of people all over. Who, a guy called Dennis King.
Dennis King?
Was it Dennis King? I'm thinking...
With
Alexander King? I can't remember. He was another one who was very, pretty much what you'd call today Malthusians. These were the ones that pretty much shifted the culture into pretty much what we see today as a post-industrial consumer-based economy. Today we're dealing with a crisis in our automotive industry. This is what we've been discussing a lot. Because we've set up, we're in a mobilization centered around that, which we set up a war room here, pretty much echoing what was done in the United States, setting up a war room there, with the intention of pushing through a solution to actually saving that automotive machine tool industry. Now, that might sound like I'm deviating, but this is the thing. What is it today that we have a crisis in our production? We have a crisis in the economy in the sense that we don't produce enough. And again, we have people in power today of this generation who are not actually investing, who are not actually supporting the legs of their economy, production, machine tools. These things are being auctioned off right now. GM, these companies are collapsing. And we're losing those machine tools. So again, we're pretty much, because of this whole orientation around a consumer economy, post-industrial economy, We're right now losing that element of our economy which actually allows us to function as a first world nation. So there's a few crises as I've gone through. And what we're going to follow this, what I want to actually follow this presentation with this briefing with, is we're going to work through, and I think we should. I'll work through is a textbook by LaRouche, who was written up in 1985, called "So You Wish to Learn Economics," going through the fundamentals on how you actually create a society which can exist and continue to exist into the future. What's the actual processes in an economy to make that happen? What do we have to recognize? And one of the biggest things that we find all the time in organizing, and the one thing that we're working right now the hardest with, is to really change this idea which has been ingrained into today's culture's minds, that man is nothing but an animal, a beast. This again, the cultural paradigm shift of the baby boomers, and going back further, is we're looking at the change of a culture. And this is pretty much it, like back to that theme of the cities of the plain. It's you have right now a culture who cannot distinguish between, or does not know in large part, the difference between man and a beast. And if they do, they say, well, often it's mystical, rather than an actual clear knowledge. So this is a historical battle that we're in, where you have right now, and this is something that we go through in pretty much all the economics we do, all the intellectual work we do, and Lynn constantly re-emphasizes, is that we really have to look at this idea, what is the fundamental difference between a man, human being, and an ape? And so you've had constantly through our history, you've had a group of people that are arguing that man cannot know anything except what his senses tell him. That he can't really understand, that he cannot really reason and understand the universe around him. He can only respond to feelings and his sensual impressions. And there's sort of like when they don't coincide, it's just bizarre, it's mystical. This is Aristotelian. This is following through pretty much a group of philosophers, people like, beginning with Aristotle. And this was picked up by all the, pretty much the empires throughout history. Going through people like, today we recognize them as, go back. We had Venetians, the Venetian oligarchical families. And then you had the philosophers that came out of that. You had people like, Paolo Sarpi. You then had people like Thomas Hobbes, John Locke, Immanuel Kant, and then going into Friedrich Nietzsche and these guys. You tend to get crazier and crazier as it went on, because that's what they had to do to sort of curb technological progress. They had to become more vicious in denouncing what is actually a human quality of reason, and they had to create more radical philosophers to counteract the optimism that was being generated through discoveries throughout history. So you sort of, today we have 6.5 billion people on this planet. And that's pretty much an indication of a developing process. Now what is the key pretty much in that sort of a development? What led to this rise in the population? And this is something that all these existential, empirical type of philosophers never talk about. They don't discuss it, because it doesn't fit in to their system that man is just an animal. Because it's one of those paradoxes. They can't explain it, because if were we just an animal, then we would be walking around on this earth with maybe 10 million at the most human beings. there's an element there that we need to look at. Something central to looking at the actual economic system and the economic ideas of LaRouche and these thinkers that we recognize in history as being those who have led to the sort of development of civilization. So there's this big battle there, and it's pretty much all because you've got to think of it like this, right? You have the economic system and the political system which your society is run on or based on is all determined by how you actually view human beings, and then you'll treat them accordingly. So you've got this big fight throughout history, political, economic fight, which led into things like the culture in general, which was fighting between two things. Man is an ape, or man is a beast. Man is pretty much a higher order of species who can reason, who can understand the universe, which is a reflection of an actual overall higher process, which gets into this idea of a creator. The idea is man is a reflection of the creator of the universe. But we can reason, we can understand how the universe works. So this is pretty much the big battle between actually creating nations or creating cultures which fostered that sort of a development, this idea of discovering how the universe works. So you've had this big battle throughout history between that sort of idea of human beings being of a higher quality of reason with those of the animal, and this pretty much the form of the battle between empires. We like to treat men like human cattle, and that of pretty much people like created the nation state, like Plato, going into like the actual nation states of Europe, and then into the actual American Revolution. So this is big battle, and it continues up to today. And this is something that we really do need to work on, really clear up in our minds. This is what actually is what Lynn says in this paper, is it's still not clear, and still needs to be understood. This qualitative difference. And so this is what we organize around. This is fundamentally it. It's those creative processes that we can master, like we can teach, and those sort of discoveries that other people can make, which lead to improvement in the society in general. That's what we do. And this is the process which right now is pretty much needed in order to actually change the sort of this chaos that's actually unfolding and has been pretty prevalent the last 40 years. So, in a sense, this is to finish up. I think I just need to re-emphasize that this difference in system, this insistence between pretty much that of what we call the American system and that of pretty much the empirical system, is the battle today. You have these bubbles being created by people like George Shultz and Dick Cheney, which pretty much want to swindle the population into keeping alive the globalization system, because that's what they rely on for their power. This is the empire power. This is that force right now, the Sinicus force. And now these are the guys who right now are working to like fighting what we're doing and losing. Right now, what Lynn has been able to do, what we've been able to do as a youth movement, is throughout the United States and here as well, is we're right now in a position where we're organizing every level of the institutions. And we're pretty much at a point where a heap of people in the United States are ready to pass this legislation by Lynn to save the auto industry. So we've got all that to keep fighting on, keep working on, get as many people in here as possible. Actually join that fight. It's a fight for humanity. So I'll end up on that and open up for questions. If the ethanol thing was not clear, I can sort of go into it a bit. I'm sort of better at responding to questions than I am just throwing things out there.
Yeah? Is the ethanol special in this week's DIR, or was it in last week's?
It's the one that no one has yet. It's on the, you can grab it off the EIW.
So it's this week's DIR?
Yeah. I think so. JP?
Can you go back on this fifth column thing?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not clear to me. I remember the Rouge warning.
Mm-hmm.
He talked about three things, like the danger of a maybe Islamic attack, groups of neo-Nazis, and just a bunch of, he called it hooligans. I guess it's a fan who's go nuts. But maybe just, I don't know if you want to. It's not clear to me exactly the fifth column thing.
Alright.
Put into the actual today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. With that, I mean, the pretty much the World Cup itself is pretty ripe. It's a ripe event because you got a lot of young people, a lot of people that are very passionate, very all rowdy. And one of the things is because of that, they tend to become irrational. You know, you see what people like at like any sort of sporting facility. They do things that usually sort of you can't explain because it's completely outside of their normal selves. They get into a mob mentality. So under those sorts of conditions, if you had some sort of devastating terror-like incident, you're going to be it's much, much more easy to manipulate the population. So, yeah, I mean, in the past, these sorts of groups that were behind terror incidents, they usually controlled a lot of groups throughout, like, all different types. When I'm talking about the syndicates, they pretty much ran operations with radical Islamist groups, like the Muslim Brotherhood. They also they controlled certain groups of the left and right. Like, one of the I was looking at a group, I think in Italy, I think it was in the 80s, there was 82 or something like that. There was a Bologna train bombing, and there was a kidnapping of the president of Italy, and this was done by a group, the Red
Brigadier de Rossi.
What?
Brigadier de Rossi, Red Brigades.
Yeah, they were a left group.
Communist.
Yeah, they were a left group. But they were pretty much run, and these sorts of groups, and we've done some investigative work into this. It's in a special report. I think maybe it's in the Madrid train bombing report, that this was run by a guy called Licio Gelli and the P2 Lodge. I think this group is another asset. And see, throughout history, you had often you had the left and the right controlled by the same groupings. So at these events, you're going to have anti-Nazis, neo-Nazis. You're going to have all sorts of people. And down the lines, I don't know the whole story, but these sorts of groups do have links into these groups, and they can be deployed in certain ways. I can follow that up, I think, but I don't know the exact ties. But the syndicates do use like these sorts of groups of all types for their plans. Does that help?
Yeah.
Check out the Madrid train bombing report. I think that might help.
Have you also read a paper that Norm put out recently on that subject?
Did you know how Iran feels about Kony's proposal yet?
Oh, it's still it's early days. The ideas, what's been known to happen is Iran puts out its proposals through Switzerland, I think it's because Swiss has always been neutral. It's always had like a history as being a neutral country. So they send their messages via Switzerland. So I think you'll see a response in the next few days. The move in general, I mean, speculation that it might be rejected. I mean, I think Dick Cheney's hoping it will be rejected for his ideas, his plans. But it's early days. Any questions? That's it. Is Val around? Because are we going to sort of just change the setting or something? We can.
Are we still doing this opera thing, or is that a
no-go?
Well, I personally don't know what the story is with that.
Why did they say? I don't know if you can just blow when people are singing.
Who's not here for it?
I don't know how many people there are.
What if your thought says other people?